Hello Manchester. You know, it's like it's Monday, so we must be in Manchester. I kind of always wanted to be a rock star. Probably that's kind of coming up. Or maybe a politician. People tell me I do have something of the Donald Trump about me. So we'll see what happens. Very, very pleased to be here in Manchester. Very grateful to the people that have made it possible, especially Michael at the back there, who I know has been organising this. Generous in accommodating us. The guys in the community upstairs. So thank you very much indeed for coming. And I'd like to say to the Manchester Buddhist Centre on behalf of Buddhafield that we feel very grateful, very pleased to be here. I have a sense of gratitude also because I come in here and I recognise where we are. So Buddhist centres around the world, actually, that are associated with Tri Ratna have all got things in common. There's a sort of a similar common atmosphere. We have a collective language and a way of communicating with each other. A lot of the images that we see, we kind of recognise. And it's just great, isn't it, to feel that we're part of... I feel enormously grateful that I'm part of that wider Tri Ratna community. So lucky. How did... You know, I just often think, how... I don't know how that happened exactly. It's very hard to imagine my life had I not come across this movement. And I think it's so easy to sort of forget just how fortunate we are of having found this thing and being able to get access to all those that have gone, as it were, before us. So as I always do, if I give a little talk like this, I always begin by saying I'm extremely grateful to my preceptor, who's called Dharmachari Maitreya Bandhu, and of course, more than anybody else, to Urgen Sangharajitta, who I'll mention as I talk under the name of Bante, Bante meaning teacher. I have to tell you that without those two people, I wouldn't have anything to say to you of any value, really. So everything that I have to say, I'm firmly a disciple of Sangharajitta. Anything I have to say, I've learnt from his writings and his work. So I begin there. Yeah? I have that gratitude which I've communicated to you now. So the title of the talk is Lifestyle as Practice. So I wanted to use that heading to give everybody some sort of idea of what the Buddhafield project is about. But I think I wanted to link it to lifestyle as practice because I wanted to say something about the way that we live our lives supports the things which are most important to us. And really, I think, to raise the question, hopefully for all of us, about that question and to encourage us to ask ourselves, is it true? Yeah? Is what I do, is where my energy goes and my actions and my activity, does it service the things which I feel are the most valuable and the most important? So people come along to Buddhafield for all sorts of reasons. And certainly that was true in London, where I was for many years, and it's almost certainly true here in Manchester. And for me, I mean, that's absolutely fine, actually. So commonly, people have found that life's not quite worked very well. Yeah? They come in because they're struggling in different ways. Certainly that's my case. People are trying to work on their maybe addictions. Certainly in London, people were extremely stressed. We were near the city. People were trying to learn how to deal with that stress. I taught one guy meditation because he wanted to improve his snooker. And before you underestimate that, he became the world champion. So I claim no, I didn't get anything out of that, which I thought wasn't quite fair. at least a little bit of the winnings, I would have thought would have been reasonable. But anyway, he didn't come back after that. So that's true, isn't it, across Triratna? It's certainly true in Butterfield. So we, we run retreats. We run, for example, a total immersion retreat that Satyamuni's mentioned. Very intensive meditation retreat, wonderful experience. A month in silence in beautiful countryside. Really an opportunity to kind of get into and deepen one's meditation. So we could say that that's one end of the scale. We run a festival that 4,000 people come to. And there's a lot of kind of dancing and, and fun, a lot of kids, all sorts of things go on there. Increasingly, a lot of Dharma input also. So people will come, they'll want to work for the cafe so they can come to the Glastonbury Festival. And very often people will say quite clearly, the one thing I'm not interested in is Buddhism. That happens here, I'm sure. But quite often people say, I'm quite interested in meditation. That sort of seems all right. But whatever you do, don't start going on about religion. That was definitely me, anyway. Maitreya Bandhu, who I mentioned, God knows how he put up with me because I raged against any kind of notion that I was going to be involved in an organized religion or anything that had ism written on the end of it. So I know that a lot of people are coming in that way. I'm sure there are people who are sitting here in this room who have those kinds of feelings about it. And do you know what? It's absolutely fine. And I'll tell you why I think it's fine. Is because if you engage with these practices, there'll come a time, and I can almost say for certain, because I've seen it so many times, when your motivation for practicing in this way begins to shift and begins to change. And I think it's something to do with when you begin to focus on your experience, when you begin to look at your mind, at your kind of heart-mind, then at some point, the question arises, who is it that's looking at this? So if I can say to you, what are you thinking? You might have to scramble about a bit, but you probably come up with some sort of answer. Or what are the sensations that you're currently feeling in your body? What is your feeling tone? You can kind of, we have a faculty, don't we, that can ask ourselves that question and come up with kind of some kind of answer. And the question arises at some point, well, what is that faculty? If I can know what I'm thinking and feeling and what sensations I have in my body, then there must be something more in these terms to me than those things. And once I found in myself, once I began to kind of explore that, the whole thing began to open out and I began to see that, actually, you know, there's something a bit more mysterious going on here. And so you could call that process, if you like, a movement towards enlightenment. If you want, you can call it that. Yeah? So I've unfortunately mentioned that word. And hopefully no one will ask me what it is, because I have no way of answering that question. It is not a thing. There's our problem. It's not something that is an end point. Yeah? Because Buddhism tells us there's no such thing as an end point. All there is momentum. There's change. Yeah? And outside of change, there is nothing in particular. There is no being that changes. So I can't achieve enlightenment because there is no such thing as I, really, and there is no such thing as enlightenment. Yeah? All there is movement and change and momentum. This is what we're told. Our inability to understand and to see that and to actually experience that is the basis of our whole problem. because we think that we exist as a fixed, unchanging entity, we spend all our time trying to back that idea up by providing ourselves with safety, security, possessions, approval, and so forth. So I can't become enlightened because there is no thing called I, yeah? And I can't become enlightened because there is no thing called enlightenment. There is flow, there is change, there is momentum. And this flow and change and momentum, we can't say much about, yeah? Which is why we have Buddha figures, because we can't really talk very much about it. And this particular rupa, I think, is the classic example of that. So this image comes from a sutta where the Buddha, you get the feeling, he just gives up, yeah? Trying to explain this thing, and he just kind of holds up a flower, yeah? And in that, some people get it. Ah, I don't know what ah means exactly. That's the whole thing, isn't it? Yeah. Trying to find out what. So there's no me. What do you mean? There's this thing called awareness. What is that? We keep being told that things are empty of. Well, what does all that mean? So I think that's the path, isn't it? That's what we're kind of in a way sort of out to do. At least those of us who are here for that reason, or for whom that motivation has become more dominant than the other motivations that may have brought us in the first place. So we can't really say, let's. If you go with me on this so far, if I can't say what enlightenment is or exactly it means, I can say something about what it's like. And throughout the Buddhist scriptures, this is broadly speaking, either it's talked about as what it's not, or it gives us kind of clues by saying that it has certain characteristics. And those characteristics are usually described as wisdom and compassion. So, okay, that sounds all right then. So we'll do that. We'll get a bit of wisdom, a bit of compassion, and then we're up and running. Yeah. And of course, what happens is you can't just decide to do these things. My experience of this is the best that we can do is to get ourselves into conditions whereby wisdom and compassion will arise. I don't know if you've had this experience in meditation. As soon as you have the idea that you want to have some kind of particular experience in meditation, in that instance, you are denied that experience. You can't push it. You can't grasp things. Yeah? All you can do in that example, is to kind of relax your body, do the techniques that we talked about with meditation, and then from those conditions, other sorts of things can be given space to arise. So to develop. So let's just talk a minute then about what these qualities of enlightenment might be. Can you let me know when I go on too long? Sort of half an hour or something, someone got to watch. So we're told that this is wisdom and compassion, and we can begin to break that down by saying, well, awareness is important. How do we develop awareness? Well, we've got certain meditation practices like the mindfulness of breathing, which helps us along that road. The enlightenment has the quality of love. You can even say that the universe has something of that. That's a very inspiring thing to believe, I find. How do we do that? Well, we've got meditation practices like the Metta Bhavana. We've got each other that we can engage with and communicate with and love. Yeah? So in those kinds of ways, we can sort of begin to experience those features of the enlightened state. These are the kinds of conditions. Something else we're told about enlightenment is that it's vast. It has no limit. Yeah? The Lotus Sutta describes it as an inconceivable emancipation, a sense of freedom which is so vast that it has no edge to it. We can't conceive of it. It's too much. Yeah? So freedom becomes the motivation, that sense of liberation, which is another way of talking about enlightenment. We look for conditions which help us to experience that. Yeah. We work on ethics because we want to move ourselves towards this sort of notion of purity. Because we become aware in our minds how we're affected by things that we've done and said, which are less than skillful. So we've got these kinds of, we've got these tools. This is the wonderful thing about Buddhism, because it's saying to you, look, here's the problem. Where we keep relying on things that are impermanent, and we're impermanent, we never get anywhere. Things just slip through our fingers. Here's the solution. So we've got this notion that there's something bigger than that, something more than that, and here's how you get there. Yeah. So this is the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's very practical. In the end, it's something that we can do, we can actually do. But I think an area that we don't talk much about in the context of Triratna is things to do with our lifestyle and the way that our lifestyle can give us opportunities, can create conditions for us to connect with this thing. And I think this is our biggest problem here in the West. We're so comfortable, aren't we? It's so difficult to sort of give up the idea that we can't make samsara, ordinary everyday life, as it were, that most people live, work in some way. So when our relationship breaks down, we don't think, well, you know what, relationship, that was always impermanent. I relied on that. And, we don't think that. We think, wrong partner. I'll find another one. Apparently these days people advertise for them. They go on dating sites or something like that. God knows how that all works. I'm so glad I'm not of this generation in so many ways. We can make it work for us, actually. Not too bad. We can get sort of a fair amount of comfort around us. We can allow ourselves time for a bit of spiritual activity and so forth. Very different story in many places in the world. I hope I'm not taking too long. I spent a little bit of time staying in a rural temple in Cambodia. It was very, very impoverished. And I tell you, the whole romanticism of the monastic life got knocked out of me in those 3 weeks that I stayed there. They let me go with them on their arms round. And I just saw how it worked. How arms round work, I realised, was that the people are so desperately poor that they don't know where their next meal is coming from. So they wake up in the morning and life is just an unending struggle for survival. And then in that environment, suddenly standing in front of them is a man in a robe who represents something higher. And for just those few minutes that it takes to put something in his bowl, they've got that kind of, they've kind of got that relief. And then and that's the deal. And it means that that person with the bowl has got to really do it. It's a horrendous crime for a monk in that situation to let people down and not do what he's representing himself to be doing. I don't know what am I talking about? How did I get onto this bit? I can't quite remember. So it's something to do, isn't it, with... I'm trying to get to is it's something to do with the way in which we actually, our lifestyle feeds our practice. And it's a real problem for us in the West because beyond a certain point, so we can come along, we start meditating, not too bad, We overcome the sort of immediate problems. We start to feel quite well. We become as a person, you know, reasonably attractive. We attract someone, and then off we go. You see, we don't go back to the Buddhist center much after that. That's a very common thing. So that's our problem. But if we look at our tradition, there's no getting away from the fact that renunciation was a very important area of practice. So the Buddha, he had the same problem. So from his comfortable world, he actually stepped out, didn't he? We all know the story. Shaved off his hair, gave away his comfortable, glamorous clothing, put on a robe, and then off he went into goodness knows where, you know, into danger, into the jungle, into the undergrowth and the underworld, mythologically as well as actually. So it wasn't just an idea. Yeah? It wasn't just a psychological process. We can easily fall into sort of saying, yes, but, you know, I kind of, you know, things are much simpler for me. I kind of got my priorities, but I haven't actually done anything. And our own teacher, Sangharacharya, did very much the same thing. In 1947, he and another guy, they threw away their passport, they threw away all their possessions, they donned a robe, and they just walked in northern India before the hippie trail. Yeah? There were no little guest houses to drop into and so forth. So going forth in that sense is very much part of the Buddhist tradition. Yeah? And in Buddhafield, although we could easily be accused sometimes of, well, playing at it, I do think that there is some attempt for us to just simplify our lives. So from the point of view of a simple, straightforward life, that doesn't mean that we have to spend all our time earning money in order to support ourselves to be comfortable. Those are the conditions which are extremely helpful for us to begin to kind of come towards something a bit more bigger than me. A couple of other things, and then I'll finish what I have to say. I'll pick out a couple of other things to do with the way that Buddhafield seeks to live and talk about it in relation to this notion of enlightenment. So nature, so we, many of us at the end of March go out to a field, and we live in a field and move around to different fields and so forth until mid-October. So in that process, in that practice, we are really in nature. Now I'm a, you know, lawless brat from a council flat in South London, so I don't know much about kind of nature. Now, I remember my first attitude was kind of, you know, okay, give me it. It's a bit of a kind of, let's have the experience. Okay, I'll have the nature experience now, you know, because I haven't got all day, you know. Let's do that now. Something, when you're actually kind of living in it and you're actually on the ground and so forth, changes about that. You just sort of become at one, to at least to some extent, with the natural world around you. You, as we were saying, you notice it when you leave more than when you're kind of actually there. What's nature like? Well, it's impermanent. If you want to experience the ever-changing nature of ourselves and of everything else, then go and sit in a field for a month. It's never the same for any kind of really kind of given period of time. If the sun's shining in the morning, it's raining by the afternoon. This is especially kind of here in England. You know, you get your coat on and because you're cold and stuff like that, and then a couple of hours later you're hot and vice versa and so on. The leaves change from green to yellow to red before your very eyes. Yeah? So living in that way is a direct experience of impermanence, and we want to have a direct experience of impermanence because that helps us to move towards this idea of liberation. Another element of Buddhafield which is very prevalent is the area of friendship. So we're often up against it. Yeah? So the rain is coming down. The people are due to arrive on the retreat, you know, tomorrow afternoon. And we still haven't got the tent up. And we don't know, and someone doesn't know where their tent pegs are. And we're tired and we're tetchy. And all the usual human stuff that kind of goes on between us. In that kind of situation, you really get to know each other. Yeah? There's no hiding place. Yeah? You get seen. And from that, you could say even adversity comes real and genuine friendship. And that's especially true if you are deliberately and consciously trying to develop that, which as Buddhist practitioners, of course, we are. There's a lot more I could say. We run retreats, we run a festival, we run a thing called a yatra, which is a walk across countryside. I know that there are people here who have had experience of these things, and I'm hoping that they might share some of their experience so that you're getting an idea about Buddha Field, not just from those of us who are in the middle of it, but from those who have come and made use of what we do. Okay, I think I've said enough. Thank you very much for listening.